Good morning. I'm Marty Bauman, and it's my pleasure to welcome you all to this meeting of the Standing Advisory Group. It's also my pleasure to welcome those listening in on the webcast. This meeting, like all of our meetings, is webcast. We have a new venue today. Apparently, Washington is very busy in July, so this room is a bit more crowded than the room we're normally in, and I see some people fanning themselves already. So we'll do our best to keep things cool. I'd like to start off by addressing some of our recent standard-setting activities very briefly, and then I'll do a brief summary of the agenda, and then I'll turn it over to our acting chairman, Dan Gelzer. As you know, the board recently proposed a new auditing standard regarding communications by auditors with audit committees. The comment period on that ended on May 28th. We received a lot of valuable comment letters, and later today we'll provide you with a summary of the comments we received. Very recently, on July 13th, the board proposed a new audit standard on confirmations. This standard, if adopted, would supersede the existing confirmation standard. The proposed standard recognizes the importance of audit evidence obtained from independent third parties, and in doing so, strengthens and extends the requirements for using confirmations in the audit process. We believe this proposed standard will improve audit quality and thereby further investor protection. A copy of this standard is in your binders, but I'll just cover a couple of the key provisions of the standard. Confirmations would be required for receivables and cash and for significant risks when confirmation adequately addresses the relevant assertions of the significant risk. The standard limits the circumstances where negative confirmations can be used and requires that because negative confirmations provide limited evidence, that auditors supplement negative confirmations with other audit procedures. The standard strengthens the requirements around the confirmation process, especially with respect to the auditor maintaining control over the process, and it more explicitly incorporates consideration of the risk of material misstatement due to error or fraud into the selection, design, and performance of confirmation procedures. It also recognizes the changes in technology and practices that have taken place since the original standard was issued, and addresses the use of electronic confirmations, the use of intermediaries, and the practice of auditors getting confirmation via direct access into respondents' records. And the auditor is required to evaluate the effect of disclaimers, which seem to be ever-increasing and restrictive language, on the reliability of a confirmation response. The proposed standard contains numerous changes from the existing confirmation standard, and it also contains significant differences from the analogous standards of the IAASB and the Auditing Standards Board. As we've done with other standards that we've proposed recently or issued, there is an appendix in the standard which compares this standard to the analogous standard of the IAASB and the Auditing Standards Board. Comments on the confirmation standard are due by September 13th. We also just issued a practice alert number 6 regarding situations where U.S. auditors are issuing reports on companies whose operations reside almost entirely outside of the United States, but where we have observed that the U.S. auditor was not appropriately following PCAOB audit standards in either using the work of the other auditor under AU 543 or supervising the work of the auditors doing the work under AU 311. You may recall that we discussed this at some length at the last SAG meeting and all viewed this as a significant practice problem. The practice alert reminds firms of their obligations when using the work of other firms or using assistance engaged from outside of the firms. With respect to the risk assessment standards, which we have proposed, reproposed, and gone over the comments with you, according to our standard-setting agenda, we plan to propose those standards to the board for final issuance in the third quarter of this year. We still think we're on schedule and on target to propose those seven or so standards to the board during this quarter. So as we've discussed with you before, we're stepping up our standard-setting activities, and I think the recent activity shows that we're trying to stay on that course. In fact, we're adding some more projects to our already busy standard-setting agenda. We'll discuss some potential standard-setting projects regarding the auditor's report and audits of broker-dealers during this meeting. So speaking of this meeting, let me turn just briefly to the agenda. I'll just give a very brief overview. The first topic we'll discuss pertains to is forward-looking. We continue to expect that legislation that is pending in Congress will give the PCAOB greater authority with respect to the audits of non-public broker-dealers. That authority could include, we expect to include, inspection, enforcement, and standard-setting authority. We want to discuss with the SAG members and receive your input about some of the issues we'll have to address with respect to this new standard-setting authority. The next agenda topic is even more forward-looking. As has been widely publicized, significant changes to many accounting standards are expected as a result of projects, both joint and individual, of the Financial Accounting Standards Board and the International Accounting Standards Board. A panel will discuss these upcoming changes, and we'll ask the SAG to consider implications on this change, both in its pace and its volume, on audits and the audit profession. One thing I'd like to ask is that we try to keep this particular discussion to a discussion of the impact of the pace of change and the volume of change on audits and auditors, and not on the accounting standards themselves. This afternoon, we'll discuss a possible standard-setting project on the responsibility of auditors related to identifying and reporting on events occurring subsequent to the financial statement date, but before the issuance of the auditor's report. This period can provide very relevant, informative, and meaningful information regarding matters that exist at the financial statement date or matters that arise after that date, which are important to investors. We'll seek your input on the auditor's role during this period, as well as the period after the report date, but before the financial statements are issued. We'll then turn to another topic that we discussed with the SAG before, and that is the auditor's report. This topic's been discussed for many years in many different forums. We are going to discuss our approach to addressing it from a standard-setting perspective, and we're going to try to present a very solutions-oriented approach to really make progress on this matter. And as I said, finally, we'll update you on the recent proposed standard on communications with audit committees. So I think we have a busy and informative and interesting agenda today. And as always, we greatly seek your active input during the meeting. Just as a reminder, whenever you want to discuss a point, just please put your name card on its edge, and we'll call on you. Now, with that, I'll turn the floor over to Dan Gelzer, Acting Chairman, for comments about recent events and other important matters.
Thanks very much, Marty. I'd also like to join in welcoming everyone to the July 2010 meeting of the Board's Standing Advisory Group. As always, we appreciate the fact that you're willing to take time from your schedules to help us in our work. Marty's highlighted some developments related to standard setting. I thought I would just touch on a few other developments affecting the board outside of the standard setting area, particularly the Supreme Court decision, the status of our foreign inspections program, the plan to create a center on the prevention and detection of fraud, and some additional comments about the impact of the changes in our broker-dealer responsibilities. First, the Supreme Court decision. I assume by now everyone is well aware that on June 28th, the Supreme Court issued its decision in the litigation that's been running for the last close to 3 years now, challenging the constitutionality of the board. In essence, of course, the court held that the provision in the Sarbanes-Oxley Act that made board members, PCOB board members, removable only for cause by the SEC was invalid. The underlying concern was that since the SEC commissioners themselves are only removable for cause, we were too insulated from presidential control by those two levels of for-cause removal. The court severed that provision from the statute. That is, it found that Congress would rather have had a PCOB with at-will removal of board members than no PCOB at all, so it simply, in effect, cut that provision out of the statute. There were also challenges to the way that board members are appointed, whether that was consistent with the Appointments Clause of the Constitution, and we prevailed on all of those issues, which was important because it's very unlikely that the court could have addressed those issues through severance. In other words, it would have been necessary to go back to the Congress in order to preserve the PCOB. So just what does it all mean? What's the fallout? Well, as the court itself said, the Sarbanes-Oxley Act remains fully operative as a law. There was some suggestion that the entire Sarbanes-Oxley Act might somehow fall if there were problems with the PCOB provisions. That certainly was not the case. We continue to function as we always have. I guess the meeting this morning is a demonstration of that. And we believe that there's nothing in the decision that in any way invalidates any standards, rules, or other actions that we've taken during the past 7 years. That's also a question that has arisen, but in our view, the decision doesn't invalidate any of our prior actions. Let me turn then to our foreign inspections program. There's been discussion with this group and in other public forums about our the difficulties that we've encountered in conducting some of our foreign inspections. It was particularly a topic of discussion at the inaugural meeting of our investor advisory group, which some of you were also at in this same room several months ago. So let me give a bit of a status report. We are still, of course, unable to conduct inspections in any of the European Union jurisdictions, in Switzerland, or in China. This certainly has a significant effect on our ability to meet our statutory responsibilities to inspect all of the auditors that, whose audit reports are filed with the SEC. This year, we're currently scheduled to inspect 81 non-U.S. firms in 28 countries. 43 of those 81 firms are in the EU, Switzerland, or China. However, there are active efforts ongoing in order to resolve these issues, particularly with the EU and Switzerland currently. As to the EU specifically, the European Commission has a group or a subgroup called the Audit Regulatory Oversight Group that is voting this week on what they would call an interim adequacy determination with respect to the PCOB. That would permit our inspections to go forward in the EU at least for a period of years. It would have to also apparently be approved or at least not objected to by the European Parliament, but we're at least cautiously optimistic that that process can work itself out in the next month or so. We would then have to begin bilateral negotiations with each of the individual EU states in which we need to conduct inspections, but presumably, hopefully, at least in most cases, that could proceed fairly rapidly. One of the major sticking points in our relations with our foreign colleagues has been our inability to share confidential inspections information with them. The Sarbanes-Oxley Act has fairly strict provisions in it about our ability to disclose non-public inspections information, and they don't extend to non-U.S. regulators. There is a provision in the Dodd-Frank bill that would correct that situation and let us, on pretty much the same terms as we can provide information to U.S. audit oversight bodies and other regulatory authorities in the United States, share information with non-U.S. Audit oversight bodies. I guess I haven't heard anything new this morning, but I think the assumption is that that bill will pass the Senate today, I guess, at least sometime this week, and then presumably be signed by the President next week. So hopefully we're on the road to addressing that issue, which will remove at least one of the stumbling blocks to our reaching agreement with some of our foreign colleagues. At the same time, there's been discussion, I think, with this group and also with some of our other advisory bodies about the disclosure that we make concerning the status of our foreign inspections. And we do have various kinds of lists on our website as to the countries in which we've been able to inspect, firms that have not been inspected for 4 years despite being subject to inspection, that sort of thing. On May 18th, we added a list of the issuers. We have a list of approximately 400 non-U.S. issuers whose last audit report was filed by or was written by a firm that we can't inspect because it's in a jurisdiction that we're unable to get into. And I think we thought that it was quite important that investors be able to understand not simply the identity of the audit firm, but the identity of the company in which they might be investing where we're not able to perform our statutory inspection functions. I would stress that I don't by any means see that disclosure as a substitute for conducting the inspections, and we do intend to pursue both through negotiations and through the other regulatory tools at our disposal the fact that we need to conduct those inspections. But again, we thought it was important that the public understand the companies involved, and we will continue to update that list and the other lists from time to time. The Anti-Fraud Center. I believe at the last meeting of this group, I mentioned that we had just recently published a posting for a director of a center on the prevention and detection of fraud. This was one of the recommendations that came to us from the Treasury's Advisory Committee on the Auditing Profession. There was considerable interest in that position. We received 24 applications, and many of them from people who would be extremely well qualified to head the center, and a staff committee is currently screening those. There'll be interviews of some of the finalists, and I guess I would say that I would hope at the next meeting of this group I'll be able to announce, or we will have announced, the head of the Fraud Center and perhaps be able to talk more about that organization's or that entity's work in preventing and detecting fraud. Certainly one of the responsibilities of the director will be to structure the Fraud Center's work. Finally, Marty's already touched a little on our broker-dealer authority, and that is going to be the subject of the next panel. Let me just say a couple of things about the impact on us apart from standard-setting activities. I think most of you are probably familiar with the general background. Section 17E of the Exchange Act requires all securities brokers that are registered with the SEC to file audited financial statements with the Commission, and Sarbanes-Oxley required the auditors who signed those audit reports to be registered with the PCAOB. There were a series of exemptive orders that prevented that provision from going into effect, but they expired at the end of 2008, and as a result, roughly 500 additional auditing firms have registered with us over the last year and a half or so. There are roughly 5,000 securities broker-dealers registered with the SEC in the United States, so this is a fairly large additional universe of companies and auditors that comes under our jurisdiction. Sarbanes-Oxley, however, does not give the board any authority to inspect these firms, to write standards for the way they perform their audits and the other kinds of reports that they're required to file with the SEC, or to bring enforcement actions against them with respect to those engagements. Again, however, the Dodd-Frank legislation would address that problem. Section 982, for those who are accounting, of the statute would essentially extend our inspection, standard setting, and enforcement authority to those 500 or so firms that are now registered with us and the audits they perform of broker-dealers. The bill also creates a funding stream to pay for that work. Essentially, the broker-dealers whose financial statements are audited by firms registered with us would have to pay an annual support fee similar to the fee paid by public companies to support or defray the cost of that part of our program. The fee would be calculated in proportion to each broker-dealer's net capital, or to reflect the proportion that each broker's net capital bears to the total net capital of broker-dealers in the United States. Section 982 could also change the registration landscape somewhat in that it only requires the registration of firms that are subject to a PCOB inspection program. And I think that reflects the fact that Congress had questions at least about whether we should be inspecting the entire universe of these broker-dealers. Some are simply what are called introducing brokers that don't have, at least in theory, don't have access to customer cash or securities. Both the SIPC and the SEC staff were on record as part of the legislative process stressing that they felt we should have jurisdiction over all of the broker-dealer firms. The AICPA and some others took a different view. So the result was to, in effect, kind of kick that issue over to us through rulemaking. So I guess the only point I would conclude with is that when the legislation passes, assuming it's going to pass, we'll have a lot to do in order to add this new responsibility to our work. We'll have to create an inspection program to cover these broker-dealers. There'll be standard-setting responsibilities, which are the subject of the next panel here this morning. We'll have a new funding system to put in place, and we'll have a new aspect of our enforcement program. That completes the summary that I wanted to, the topics I wanted to cover. I guess with some trepidation, I'll say if there are any questions, I'll be happy to try and answer them. Otherwise, we're ready for the next topic. Lynn.
Dana, three questions for you. Two on the inspections and one on the anti-fraud center, and it sounds like you're actually starting to make progress on the foreign inspections, which I think is great news. In what the EU is working on, are they putting any limitations on your ability to go in and do the foreign inspections? Are there certain protocols? Are they requiring their people go in with you? What, if any, limits are they putting on them, or are they going to let you go ahead and do an inspection much like you do here in the U.S.? And either you or a question also for Brian, the list that you put out is excellent in terms of the 400 registrants, but most investors wouldn't have a clue that that list is out there. Either through the auditor's report or other disclosure, have either of you considered requiring those 400 registrants to make disclosure of the fact that their audits haven't been inspected? That's the second question. Then finally, on the anti-fraud center, getting the new director on is certainly a good progress, but how many people are you budgeting now then to be in the anti-fraud center along with the director?
See, I don't think Rhonda Schneer is here this morning. As to the EU, at least my understanding is that in what they're looking at, there's nothing that would limit our ability, the way that we conduct our foreign inspections. They are thinking, I believe, of a time limitation, probably something in the neighborhood of 3 years, so that these issues would come back again in 3 years. I think I can say with some confidence that we wouldn't be able to agree to any limitations because, obviously, anything we agree to with one country, we're then almost forced to agree to it with all countries, and so we can't go down that kind of road. But, again, I'm not aware that they're considering that anything that would be problematic in that regard. There, as I said, there would then have to be negotiations, as there always are, with each individual jurisdiction about the exact terms and conditions and protocol under which inspections would occur in that country, but that is something that we're fairly used to doing. It's the day-to-day work of our Office of International Affairs. As to disclosure in audit opinions, when we're not able to inspect the firm, I think that's been discussed publicly, is that is definitely something that would be on the agenda of steps that we could take. I think the feeling, at least to date, has been if it looks like there's a realistic possibility of solving these problems and going in and performing the inspections, then we don't have to turn to that step or other kinds of steps that we could take. But I think it's very much on all our minds that process can't go on forever. I mean, at some point we have to turn to these other steps. And as to the staffing of the fraud center, I mean, I don't think there's really an answer to that question at the moment. We're now in the process of formulating what our 2011 budget submission to the SEC would be like. Nothing's been submitted yet, and I don't believe there's been any discussion with the SEC staff about that topic. I don't think it currently envision that next year the staff would be large, probably more in the range of two or three, something like that. But again, a lot of that is because the director is, and I guess we have kind of broad ideas about what the center would be, but somebody's going to have to be put in that position and then really come up with a detailed plan as to how the center would operate and what it would do, and then I think its ultimate staffing would fall out of that plan.
Jeff Mahoney.
Thank you. Mr. Chairman, you noted that the Anti-Fraud Center is directly responsive to one of the recommendations of the Treasury Committee report. Can you just briefly give us an update of the status and timing of your responses to the other Treasury Committee recommendations?
I did that in April, and it took me about a half an hour. And we have put that list on the website. I guess we ought to look to updating that list as there are developments. Jeff, I think about all I can say at the moment is that we're quite mindful of all those recommendations and do intend to keep working on them. I mean, the auditor's reporting model is certainly a big subject that's also on the agenda for this meeting. I know there's a lot of interest in engagement partner signature of the audit report, and I think what the published standards agenda says is that the staff would be making a recommendation to the board during the second quarter, which ended a few days ago, and any further action would occur during the third quarter. So I'll let it go at that.
But. Yeah, on that particular one, I think that's something where we're prepared to, and our Office of General Counsel together are prepared to sit down with the board and talk about next steps on that one right now. So I think that'll be an issue that during the third quarter we'll have discussions with the board about next steps. If there are no other questions, we'll proceed to the next topic on the agenda, which pertains to audits of broker-dealers and the pending legislation in that regard, but our potential standard-setting authority with respect to that. I'll ask Bill Gradison to please make some introductory comments on the matter. Bill, thanks.
Thank you, Marty. I think I've been asked to do this because when I was out in the real world before I contracted Potomac fever, I made a living as a general partner of a non-public broker-dealer and had a lot of contact with our outside auditors, Haskins and Sells at the time, now part of Deloitte. I think that it's important to recognize that we actually have registered a lot of auditors of non-public broker-dealers in the past if they were also auditing issuers. So the new universe are auditors who don't currently audit issuers, but just audit non-public broker-dealers. And that registration part of the process is pretty well complete, up 4,500, whatever the numbers are. But that's just the first step. There are a lot of other things that are going to have to happen for this program to work effectively. A specialized training will be required to perform these inspections with all that that entails with regard to recruitment and training. And it's going to require a significant increase in our PCOB headcount. It's not that we don't have inspectors with knowledge in this field. We have some very able ones, but we don't have enough to go out at all, to go out and do this work in addition to their other responsibilities. As Dan has mentioned, a system of fees will have to be put into effect so that issuers can be assured that they are not carrying the cost of this new program. Each of those would have to stand on its own. And in November of this year, the PCOB budget proposal will go to the SEC for next year, And it's going to, of course, have to cover the responsibilities, these new responsibilities. And that budget process, as Dan has mentioned, it's going along. But there are a lot of elements that feed into the additional costs that will be entailed, not just the inspection element, although that's the largest part. And that'll be, of course, has to be in a form and an amount that's satisfactory to the SEC. With regard to standards for issuers, though, this is a very different situation than we faced back in our early days in 2003, because we were permitted by statute to adopt on an interim basis the then existing ASB, if you will, standards. And so we had something to start with, but my best understanding, and we'll learn a lot more about this in the next hour, of the situation with regard to broker-dealer standards is that we sort of start with a clean slate. And this is going to mean an enormous challenge, not just in terms of substance, but in terms of the timing. I mean, it takes time to write these standards and to seek comments and to respond to the comments and, you know, work it all through the SEC. And that's going to be a big job. Another fundamental difference is that unlike conventional audits, which, of course, are focused on the accuracy and the reliability of financial reporting, broker-dealer audits include control over customer assets, which are not included in the broker-dealer's financial statements, as well as the very important verification of that the broker-dealer meets the net capital requirements. Unlike a PCOB statutory role, and these are the words of the statute, you know, protecting investors through improving the accuracy and reliability of corporate disclosures, in the case of broker-dealer audits, the focus is on protecting the investor as a customer rather than as as an owner or a creditor of a public company, which I think is somewhat significant. These are uncharted waters for the PCOB, and we look forward in the next hour of having your views on how we should proceed. And now I'll turn it over to Barb. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill, and good morning and welcome. As Marty mentioned, our discussion topic on broker-dealers is somewhat unique to other discussion topics in that, as of today, we don't yet have the authority to inspect, investigate, or discipline the auditors of non-public broker-dealers. However, due to the magnitude of the possible effect of getting this authority, we did think it was timely to talk to you about it today, as there would probably be a great desire to move expeditiously once we get it. A significant aspect of getting this potential authority is that the board would need to expand rules and standards to cover the audits of broker-dealers, which would likely include developing or amending existing audit, attest, and related professional practice standards that we have today. So today we're hoping to provide you with an overview of the current regulatory requirements relating to the audits of broker-dealers, and then to seek your views on certain aspects of these audits. Broker-dealer is defined broadly in the securities law. A broker-dealer is an individual or firm that is engaged in the business of trading securities for its own account or on behalf of its customers. It operates in an industry that is highly regulated. Broker-dealers must be registered with the SEC and are subject to a number of rules and regulatory requirements. Two significant SEC rules that we'll talk about throughout this discussion are Rule 15.3-1, which is the net capital requirements for broker-dealers. It establishes that broker-dealers must maintain adequate liquid assets to meet their capital requirements. And Rule 15.C.3-3, which is a customer protection rule regarding reserves and custody of securities. It requires, among other things, to have a broker-dealer establish a special reserve account for the protection of customers. And it also requires that a broker-dealer have custody or control of certain customer securities. The applicability of these rules and some of the regulatory reporting requirements may vary based on the nature of the business activities of each broker-dealer. For example, an introducing broker-dealer may accept customer orders but clears or processes the orders through another broker known as a clearing broker. The clearing broker, among other things, receives and executes customer instructions and settles the money related to trades. Because introducing brokers do not hold customer accounts, they typically don't have to comply with Rule 15C3-3 regarding possession and control of securities. Broker-dealers are required to be members of the Financial Industry Regulatory Authority, which has responsibility for oversight of the over-the-counter securities market. With limited exceptions, broker-dealers are also required to be members of the Securities Investor Protection Corporation, which serves a similar purpose as the FDIC, and is designed to protect up to a specific maximum amount customer cash and securities in the event the broker-dealer fails and is liquidated. Broker-dealers must file annual financial statements with the SEC, who has established rules regarding audit requirements. Specifically, Rule 17A5 requires that annual reports made by broker-dealers include audited financial statements. It also requires the audit to include a review of the accounting system, the internal accounting and control, and procedures for safeguarding securities, as well as for the audit to include all procedures necessary to enable the auditor to express an opinion on the financial statements, including the computation of net capital under Rule 15C3-1, the computation for the determination of the reserve under 15C3-3, and information regarding the possession or control requirements under Rule 15C3-3. The SEC rule further requires that the scope of the audit and review of the internal accounting system and internal control and procedures, they require the auditor to provide reasonable assurance that any material inadequacies existing at the date of the examination in the areas of these rules are disclosed. Rule 17A5, however, does not include specific requirements regarding the extent and timing of audit procedures. Broker-dealers must file their audited financial statements with the SEC within 60 days of their fiscal year end, along with the auditor's report on internal control required by Rule 17A5, and a supplemental report by the auditor which includes procedures related to the SIPC Annual General Assessment Reconciliation Form. The audit opinion that is filed with the financial statements includes a paragraph which covers the required supplementary schedules regarding the reserve calculation and the net capital calculation. Currently, the auditor's report on internal control required by Rule 17A5 is not specifically addressed in the standards of the AICPA, nor would there be a specific PCAOB standard which would address this report if we were given authority to inspect broker-dealers. An example of the form of the report, which is currently accepted by the SEC, is included in the AICPA's Audit and Accounting Guide on Broker-Dealers and Securities. In understanding how the audits of broker-dealers are unique to the audits of issuers, which we would now inspect, it's important to understand that customer securities held by broker-dealers are neither measured in a broker-dealer's financial statements, nor are they disclosed in the footnotes to the broker-dealer's financial statements. For example, in a bank's financial statements, the deposits of customers are reflected as a liability on the bank's balance sheet and are thus likely subject to audit procedures in the audit of a bank. The investments reflected in the financial statements of a broker-dealer represent only the broker-dealer's proprietary positions and not customer positions. Broker-dealers maintain a separate set of books referred to as the stock record, in which they record both their customer and their own securities transaction. As only the broker-dealer's proprietary position is reflected in its audited financial statements, an examination of the stock record that reflects customer securities may not necessarily be an integral part of the financial statement audit. The extent of audit procedures performed on the stock record may vary among firms because there are currently no specific audit requirements in the AICPA's auditing standards pertaining to customer securities. While many auditors use the AICPA audit guide on broker-dealers, which includes a number of suggested procedures that the auditor should perform, the audit guides are not authoritative, and as such, the suggested procedures are not requirements. As I think Dan mentioned, there are now approximately 500 firms that have registered with the PCAOB because they audit non-public broker-dealers and have therefore not necessarily applied the rules and standards of the PCAOB. So considering this, along with the regulatory requirements that are numerous regarding the audit, the staff today is seeking your view on what audit attest and professional practice standards the board may need to consider for broker-dealer audits. This brings us to our first discussion question. Oops. Because of existing SEC requirements, would the PCAOB need to establish specific auditing attest or professional practice standards for broker-dealer audits? And if so, what would they be? And I think we could probably also open it for the second discussion question at the same time, which is what other matters would the PCAOB need to consider in developing these standards for broker-dealer audits? Wayne Collins?
Yeah, I would guess the beginning would be to look at the guide. Now it's in the guide, notwithstanding that there probably are some gaps with 1A in the guide. And even though it's not authoritative, and I think the preface to the guide indicates that, it does indicate that auditors that do not follow the recommendations in the guide should be prepared to justify why they did not. So, again, I wouldn't start with a blank piece of paper. I'd start with the guide and then and chisel around it and add those things which need to be added. And in looking at the report on as broker-dealer auditors call it, the MI letter, is the report on the controls, the material inadequacies, there are some inconsistencies within that report. There's a definition of material weaknesses which relates to financial statements, and then there's a conclusion with respect to material weaknesses relating to both financial statements and safeguarding securities, so that seems to be inconsistent. And then there's a separate paragraph dealing with material inadequacies with respect to the system of safeguarding securities, yet material inadequacies is not defined in that report, although it is defined in the 17A5.
Galen Hansen.
Excuse me. I think I would start with that guide as well, but I would also roll back to have some discussions with the SEC about what they're seeing as exceptions and really going back to what is the objective that we're trying to accomplish here. I guess I'm a little bit bothered with the idea that it seems to me that the risk here is outside of the financial statements. It's in the stock record. And so either that stock record somehow needs to be reflected in the financial statements or the focus of the inspections need to be on the stock record. And I think that whole issue needs to be settled up front. As far as the standards themselves that the PCAOB would be thinking about, I think you're absolutely right. You got to go back through everything that you've already issued and see to what extent those are going to apply and how they apply to this. Do the independence rules apply to documentation standards? Is this an integrated audit? To what extent is that going to change the audit guide? I mean, this is a great opportunity for somebody to spend a lot of time.
As I've found out.
And I'm sure you've discovered that. So those are basically... But I'm sure that the SEC has had some issues that have evolved over the course of the years. We've been doing these reports for a long time, these audits for a long period of time. Certainly there have been some problems that could be focused on, and going back to some of the recent problems with broker dealers, what are those issues that led to those problems, and how can these inspections have any impact on those? Would be something that I think you'd be interested in.
Galen, I appreciate your comment that this is a great opportunity, and we'll look forward to this opportunity. I'm sure it'll keep Barbara and some others busy. I think the point Galen made is very important. I think it's worth reflecting just for a moment on it, and I see a lot of other cards up, but I think the real reason this authority and our authority over the audits of non-public broker-dealers was given to us is really about, as Bill had mentioned before and as Galen has added to, it's the trillions of dollars of customer assets, your assets, everybody's assets around this table, that are not in the financial statements at all, not on the balance sheet, not in the footnotes, not anywhere, but they're held by these broker-dealers. And so I think it's the real important thing that's we're going to deal with in our standards, I believe, is not just the audit of those financial statements, but it's the audit and the reporting on the safeguarding and controls over trillions of dollars of customer assets that are outside the financial statements. So it's a very non-traditional sort of issue that we'll be dealing with here with compared to other audits of issuers that we've been performing. And as was mentioned, there's suggested procedures in the audit guide, but no requirements. Barbara Rover?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually precisely the point that I wanted to reinforce from what Galen said is, I mean, no one suddenly gave the PCAOB this authority because they were concerned primarily about the audits of the financial statements of non-public broker-dealers. The exemption, you know, the decision about extending the exemption for non-public broker-dealers came up at the time when the Madoff case was in the headlines, and nobody had the political courage to try to explain why these were actually two really sort of very different functions. But I think it actually does expose an area that may be subject to inadequate oversight, where there is a potential to strengthen, as you say, the audits of the maintenance of these customer accounts. It is fraught with danger. I mean, one of the big misconceptions about Madoff case, I mean, Madoff was lying. He said he didn't have any customers. I mean, so whether he would even come into the population that you would normally be looking at for these kind of audits is a question of how you determine the scope. And you sort of walk into a danger area where you then become one of the parties that's responsible for not catching something that isn't necessarily all that easily catchable when it's simply a matter of someone running two entirely different set of books, hiding operations in a different set of the company. So I think it would be beneficial, as Galen suggests, to start with as much of a data dump as you can get from the SEC, from FINRA, from the states, about the kind of cases that you're likely to have, the kind of problems that are likely to emerge in this area, to figure out, to trigger your thoughts about what procedures would be likely to catch them. Because it is, you know, I think you're absolutely right. It is an entirely different function that you're being asked to come in and perform.
Thank you.